thank you for taking the time to listen to this life-changing message from the Ministry of Faith Bible Chapel. We hope this message will encourage you in all parts of your life. At the end of this message, you will hear more information on how to contact our church family, as well as directions for you to visit us for any of our worship services. Until then, join us for the service in progress.
Those are holidays that God commands the Jewish people in the Bible to celebrate each year as a way of recognizing his movements and his work in their midst. Purim is not a biblical holiday, but it's a holiday that the Jewish people have established that celebrates God's protection and his deliverance of them, a very special and dramatic event that took place in their history as the Jewish people. So Purim commemorates the deliverance of the Jewish people from the destruction of their enemies. It's a theme that the Jewish people are very familiar with all throughout their history, and it's one that glorifies God and his protection in their lives, especially in this story of Purim. Ironically, though, throughout the whole story of Purim, God isn't even mentioned, but his fingerprints are all over the story as we see miraculous events taking place, protecting his people and protecting his purpose through them. The word Purim is actually a Hebrew word, which means the lots. It's the plural of lot or casting lots, which were cast as a way to determine and to choose when the date would be for the massacre of the Jewish people. So the decision had already been made that the Jewish people were going to be massacred and destroyed, and so lots were thrown to determine what date would that event would take place on. Most of us are familiar with the story of Esther, the story of Purim. It's an amazing story of deliverance. It's a classic narration of good versus evil, and is told in our own Bibles in the biblical book of Esther. And just like all the other Jewish holidays, this one is a joyous time for the Jewish people to look and to remember God's protection in their lives, and to look at how God has moved and the fact that they are God's chosen people. So Purim is celebrated every year, annually, on the 15th day of Adar, the Jewish month of Adar on the Jewish calendar, which usually happens for us in the springtime. And so it happens in March, and sometimes it happens even late in February or sometimes in April, but it happens in the springtime on the 15th of Adar. And it's a fun filled holiday. The Jewish people are commanded to eat, drink, and be merry, and to be ruckus, and to have a good time, and to really celebrate. And it's done with lots of food and costumes and giving of gifts to one another. Typically, the Jews will gather together in a public square or a synagogue, a temple, and a community center. And the whole focus is to read the Book of Esther, the Megillah, or the scroll of the Book of Esther. Hi, guys. And as a part of the celebration, children will dress up in costume. And usually they'll dress up as one of the characters from the story of the Book of Esther. They'll either dress up, the little girls will dress up as Queen Esther, or the boys will dress up sometimes as Mordecai or as King Xerxes. Sometimes they'll even dress up like the villain, Haman. These days in Israel, however, you see less Esthers and Mordecais and King Xerxes. You'll actually see costumes of every kind. It's just a holiday to celebrate and to have a good time. And so there's lots of different costumes. And pretty much any costume goes as long as it makes it for a good time of celebrating and joy. Let's give our kids a big hand. Aren't they great? Just like every Jewish holiday, food has to be a part of that celebration. There's a fun saying that goes like this almost every Jewish holiday, but especially at Purim, the Jewish people will say, "They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat." So food gifts are given during Purim to friends and family, and one of the special food gifts are these little cookies called hamantaschen. They're a little cookie that's filled with usually some kind of a fruit paste or a date paste or chocolate or some goodie. And these are out actually for weeks before Purim, but especially on Purim, then we give them to each other as gifts. And tonight we have some of these for you at the back in the atrium tonight after the service is over as a gift to you, our friends. We want you to celebrate with us the gift of Purim. And so these little cookies will be for you in the back. And go ahead and enjoy those. And don't forget that those will be back there. So those are Hamantaschen. Hamantaschen is a Yiddish word that actually means Haman's pockets, and it represents the hat that Haman, the villain of the story, would have worn, or they're also called Ozni Haman, Haman's ears, and also represents Haman's ears or his hat that he would have worn on his head. The center of the whole celebration, though, is the reading of the Book of Esther, the Megillah, the Scroll of Esther, and so the reading will be done publicly. Everybody will come together, and it's a joyous time. It's a fun time, and they'll read the story from beginning to end without stopping, and they're kind of commanded through the story to be as loud and obnoxious as they can be. So as they're going through the story, the children especially, but the adults also will have these little groggers or noisemakers in their hands, and as the story is read aloud, when they get to the hero and the heroine, Mordecai and Esther, the whole audience will erupt with cheers and yahoos and woo, and they applaud the hero and the heroine. But then when they get to the villain, the Haman, and his name is mentioned in the story several times, the whole audience erupts in screams and boos and hisses and stomping their feet and making noise with their groggers. So much noise that often the story, you can't even hear the storyteller telling the rest of the story. But the whole idea is to have lots of fun remembering the story and remembering God's deliverance of the Jewish people in this very crucial time. And then one of the most unique parts and fun parts of the Purim festival is the giving of gifts to the poor. And we're going to have an opportunity to do that tonight. We're going to take up an offering, a gift for a very unique and amazing outreach in Israel called Redeemed in Zion. Redeemed in Zion is working to help the very, very poor all throughout Israel. And they help them in a very unique and special way by giving them appliances. Now, in America, we just take appliances for granted. Everybody has the stove and a refrigerator and a washer and a dryer. But in Israel, there's lots and lots of people that do not have those things. So Redeemed in Zion comes in and helps and gives gifts to those families and to those people. Not replacing a refrigerator that's broken, actually giving one that what didn't exist before. And so that's part of the gifts that are given during Purim. So as we look at God's amazing story of faithfulness and deliverance, the Purim story, we're going to look here at the video of the roots of Purim, and then we'll continue.
Comes the purpose of a person's life. Come it by chance, a casting of the lot, or does a call of destiny beckon to each of us? Many have wondered about my little Hadassah and why a simple Jewish orphan was chosen to stand against the annihilation of her people. And yet the mystery of the girl most known as Esther begins not where one might think, but 500 years earlier with a single act of disobedience. King Saul of the Israelites had been sent by the prophet Samuel to wipe out an ancient child-sacrificing enemy. So pervasive was their evil that not even their oxen nor sheep were to be spared. And above all, no survivors left breathing.
Agag, king of the Amalekites. We have also seized for you his livestock, even his queen.
Oh. Dark portents bid me haste across this land of ours.
How would you accuse me now, O prophet? I carried out your lord's command.
Then why do my ears ring with the lowing of oxen and the bleating of sheep?
Your Majesty, the Amalekite queen. She's escaped.
We have the king. What is one woman?
You fool. She is with child.
The prophet Samuel put a swift end to King Agag. Agag's queen, fleeing with a seed of vengeance growing within her, the Jews never found. While many Jews had forgotten the acts of centuries past, the descendants of Agag had not. For Agag's queen did indeed survive and gave birth to a son. And she forged for him a mark, prophesying that one day an Agagite would arise, a descendant of Agag, who would finally exact vengeance upon the Jews.
Good evening. It was 400 years after 400 years of slavery in Egypt that the Jewish people were miraculously freed by God through Moses and Aaron. Shortly after the Exodus, sometime around the 14th century BC, the Israelites were attacked by a people called the Amalekites in an attempt to wipe them out. About 400 years later, during the reign of King Saul, Samuel the prophet brought word from the Lord that the Amalekites were to be destroyed. Fast forward another 500 years to the time of Israel's captivity in Persia. This is about 355 BC. This is the setting for the story of Purim in the book of Esther. Purim, literally lots that are cast, refers to the lots Haman cast to determine the day of destruction for the Jewish people. The lots are significant here. Haman's choice to carry out this genocide based on the roll of a dice was an attempt to put to rest the fears his empire had about the ancient God of Israel. Many Persian kings at this time in history studied the prophecies recorded in Jewish scriptures, and it was popular at the time to believe that miracles and prophecy were legends of the past, and that perhaps the God of Israel was no longer relevant. So Haman's attempted genocide of the Jews was to him a test. Is God relevant? Is he alive? Will he respond and protect his people? Sounds familiar to today. Now, God doesn't miraculously deliver the Jewish people here. He doesn't part the Red Sea like he did in the Exodus. What the book of Esther says, in fact, like Mike pointed out, it doesn't even mention the name of God. Instead, we see recorded a bunch of series of events, which taken by themselves don't seem too out of the ordinary, perhaps even a little coincidental. But taken together, they are a miraculous series of events orchestrated by him on behalf of his people. Let's look at these real quickly. King Ahasuerus holds a spectacular six-month feast in Shushan, the capital city of Persia. Queen Vashti refuses to obey the king's drunken request. A beauty contest is held to replace her. Esther, a Jewish girl, is chosen by the king. A plot to assassinate the king just so happened to be overheard by Mordecai, who just so happened to be Esther's relative. He foils the plot, and his acts of loyalty are recorded in the king's records. The king can't sleep one night, and he calls for that book of records. He just so happens to open to the page detailing Mordecai's long-forgotten act of loyalty. At this point, Haman approaches the king asking for Mordecai's death. Instead, the king orders Haman to parade Mordecai on horseback through the streets, and he dresses him in royal robes. We then find Haman, we know the rest of the story, is hanged on the very gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. So the heroics of Mordecai and Esther are in recognizing that God is a God of his word, and that they acted in faith and obedience. Now, Haman's worldview was one of happenstance or chance, and this worldview is completely obliterated by the Jewish belief that God is ever present. History shows God keeps his word. He is not a God of chance or fate, but one of purpose and promise. Will we disobey like Saul, or we will obey like Mordecai and Esther?
We're told that Haman's father was an Agagite. And so Haman's father was a descendant of the disobedience of Saul, the disobedience of the children of Israel. And then Haman becomes another descendant of disobedience. Haman had great anger and great hatred. And he focuses it on Mordecai because Mordecai refuses to bow to him. Commentaries tell us that it wasn't because Mordecai said, "I will only bow to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," because it was recorded that Jews did show respect to the kings, and that Jews would bow in respect to the kings. But Mordecai knew who Haman was. Haman was a descendant of disobedience who had been taught great hatred. And Mordecai understood what the Agagites would want to do to the Jews. And so Haman's anger towards the Jews turned to hatred. And his hatred turned to murder. Out of control emotions always lead to disaster. You see, Haman's anger was not just at Mordecai. No, it was at Mordecai the Jew. If you read history, that's exactly how history always comes down. It isn't that it's this person that I'm upset with, or it's this person historically that somebody's upset with. It is always what? The Jews. It becomes a collective thing of anti-Semitism that throughout history has had roots. Haman's decision was driven by his hatred of the Jews, but it cost him his own life and the life of his family. I want to camp on that for a moment. We cannot afford to think that we can make decisions in a vacuum. We cannot afford to think that we can fester in one another, in our children, in our friends, certain prejudices that don't come back around at a point in history and do you and your family damage. You know, ungodly decisions always have their effect not only on our lives but on the lives of others. And the Jews during Purim make great noise to drown out the name of Haman. It isn't necessarily Haman's name that they're trying to drown out. He is only the focus of this story. But what Jews have focused their lives on is survival and wiping out those that would try to destroy them. I urge you to take some moments tonight. Come over and pray with us in the prayer chapel for Israel, because Haman is alive and well in the same region where Haman was during the time of Purim. His name is Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran. Nothing has changed. He's saying he wants to wipe Israel off the map. What did a Jew ever do to him? But deep hatred and anti-Semitism drives people to do heinous and hideous things, and it drives us to do the same. God tells us in Galatians chapter 5, but the fruit of the Spirit. God has given to us His Spirit. God has given us the ability to walk above these kinds of things. God has given us the ability to minister life and truth into our families and into our friends, and not prejudice and death. It says that the fruit of the Spirit is love. That's the opposite of hate. Joy, which is the opposite of depression, and I don't get what I want. Peace, that's the opposite of turmoil that drives me to the unbelievable things. Long-suffering, that helps me understand. That always jumping to an immediate conclusion about a circumstance or a person is always and usually wrong. Kindness. When we begin to act kind towards others, we begin to feel kind. Goodness. When we exercise goodness in this world is a better place. Faithfulness. Staying faithful to our marriages and faithful to our families is a hallmark of driving a stake into our society that says this is different. That those who know Christ and walk in His Spirit are different. Not better, not superior, but different. Gentleness. That a word of gentleness and an act of gentleness can turn away wrath and anger. Self-control. That we need to realize that God has given us the ability through the fruit of the Spirit to walk in self-control and not let our flesh rule us. When we do this, look at this last. It says, against such there is no law. What does that mean? When we walk in the fruit of the Spirit, there is no judgment against us. When we walk outside of it, we are surely going to step into consequences that we didn't plan. Big difference between Haman and the very godly, faithful, loving, peaceful, long-suffering, kind, good, gentle, and self-controlled Mordecai.
Just as Haman was the great nemesis in the story of Esther, Mordecai is one of the great heroes of the story. But who was Mordecai? Let's take a look at that and see what we can find in the scriptures. We know that Mordecai was a Jew. We know that Mordecai was from the tribe of Benjamin, and that Mordecai's family was taken into exile from Jerusalem by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. We also know that Mordecai was Esther's cousin, and it says that he raised her from the time of her parents' death. The scholars have said there's no evidence anywhere that shows that Mordecai was ever married, so more than likely, he was a single dad, and he raised Esther with the values that he wanted her to have, that God would have imparted and her parents would have imparted, that she used to become another hero of the story of the book of Esther. Mordecai had a high place in the king's court. Mordecai lived in the palace complex, and he served King Xerxes well. After Esther had been made queen, the first big turning point in this story takes place. Mordecai overhears a plot of some people who are planning to kill King Xerxes. Mordecai gets that information to Queen Esther, who in turn gets that information to King Xerxes, and because of that, the king's life is spared. As a result, Esther made it a point to let the king know that it was her uncle, Mordecai, her cousin, excuse me, Mordecai, who had given her that information. And he brought the scribes in and had them make a note of that in the scriptures you see in Esther chapter 2, verse 23. It says, when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both of the men were hanged on the gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. This is an important thing, that it was inscribed in the book of the king that Mordecai had done something on the king's behalf. This piece will come in handy later in the story. In the meantime, Haman, who Cheryl just shared with you about, has been appointed the second highest ranking official in the king's government. But Mordecai would not bow down to him. That was the next turning point in the story. Mordecai would not bow. And as a result, Haman sets in plan this motion to destroy all the Jews. And as Cheryl said, not just because Mordecai wouldn't bow to him, but it was when he found out Mordecai was a Jew that his mind went to this next level of, I want to destroy all the Jews. In Esther chapter 3, verse 8, you see that recorded. Then Haman approached King Xerxes and he said, there is a certain race of people scattered through all the provinces of your empire. Their laws are different from those of any other nation, and they refuse to obey even the laws of the king. So is it not in the king's interest to let them live? Mordecai wants the Jews dead. Excuse me, Haman wants the Jews dead. My apologies. But the question is, why wouldn't Mordecai bow? Of course, we know Mordecai wouldn't bow to Haman because Mordecai would only bow to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, his God. But it was commonplace for people to bow to Haman. He was in a position of authority. He was a prince. He had been promoted by the king. A decree had been made by the king that people should bow to Haman and be showing him honor. But we also have to understand the context of what that bowing meant, and the absolute reason why Mordecai would not bow was because in those days, bowing to him was not just showing him governmental honor, but it was considered an act of worship towards Haman. And Mordecai would never worship Haman, only the one true God. There's some similarities in the story of Mordecai to some of the other biblical stories in the past that you may notice, specifically the story of Joseph and the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I want to point out a couple quick things to you. If you look at the story of Joseph, Joseph would not give in to Pharaoh's wife and dishonor his God. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow down to the graven image of Nebuchadnezzar and dishonor God. And Mordecai would not bow to Haman and dishonor God. Because Joseph would not give in, he went to prison. Because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not give in, they were sent to the fiery furnace. Because Haman would not give in, his people were targeted for annihilation. Because Joseph, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Mordecai stood up for what is right in the eyes of God, they personally endured suffering for a season. And lastly, as a result of following their convictions and doing the right thing, Joseph was made second in command to Pharaoh and was able to save his family and his people. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were saved in the furnace, promoted in position in Babylon, and King Nebuchadnezzar changed his heart and decreed that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would be worshipped in Babylon. And because Mordecai followed his convictions, the Jewish people were saved, and Mordecai was made second in command. So what do we take for that for us today? How can we apply this to our lives today? I felt like the Holy Spirit showed me three things. One, on your notes, you can fill these in. We live in an age of compromise and tolerance. Second, Mordecai was a man of great courage and conviction. And third, we cannot be afraid to stand for truth, and we must refuse to conform to the world. We live in an age of compromise and tolerance. We need to be people of courage and conviction, and we can't be afraid to stand for truth, and we must refuse to conform to the world. Romans 12:2 says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. We need to be the Mordecais of 2012. We need to never give in. We need to never compromise, even if it means a season of suffering for us and maybe for our families. In the end, God will be faithful and he will reward us for standing for what is truth and for what is right.
Amen. I'm thrilled to talk to you all about Esther because Esther has been my hero since I was a little girl. And I will admit to you, though, I think I had a rather romanticized view of her relationship with King Xerxes. I kind of imagined it as the king comes and sweeps Esther off her feet and they ride into the sunset. And I know that's probably obviously wrong. As I was continuing to really look at the book of Esther and just look at the story a little bit more in depth, I realized that their relationship might have been a bit more strained than I first thought. At the beginning of the story, King Xerxes is giving this huge banquet. He's been displaying his wealth for 180 days. And the Bible says that he had displayed the splendor and glory of his majesty, keyword being his majesty. He did not have a relationship with the Lord. He did not understand that God was the one who had given him these gifts, talents, and abilities. And so that in and of itself was difficult. Secondly, he told his servants at the beginning of this huge banquet for all the men in his province, he said, give them as much wine as they want. And so we know for sure that this was a drunken party. And at the end of that party, he said, all right, I would like to command Queen Vashti to come and to display herself before these men. Now, some commentators say that he was saying she needed to wear just her crown and come before these men. Whatever the case, it was a bad situation. And sometimes I think Queen Vashti gets a negative rap, and then people say, well, she was selfish, she wasn't under authority. But I really believe she made a courageous decision to say, no, I'm going to be a woman of purity, and she did not come before those men. It's really interesting to note that the successor to King Xerxes was King Artaxerxes, who was actually Queen Vashti's son. And I believe that God gave her a chance later on to speak into her son's life and to be able to mold him and shape him. He came into power at age 18. So I believe God gave Vashti the opportunity because she stood for what was right. She was able to speak into her son's life and make an impact. How awesome is God to bless our faithfulness. Fast forward 4 years, Queen Esther comes on the scene. She's a Jewish woman, a devout Jewish woman, and here she comes walking into this palace, and it's the world. She's walking into a place of worldliness and ungodliness. The Bible says that she was in the harem for a year with concubines. You can only imagine what must have been going through her mind as she experienced this very different lifestyle from what she had been used to. The Bible says that even after Queen Esther was crowned queen, the king continued to enlarge his harem. That's amazing. That relationship must have been so difficult based on the surroundings and what was culturally acceptable at that time. However, I believe that Esther continued to stand for righteousness. Your next point, it says Esther was a devout Jewish woman who desired to maintain godly standards in a pagan world. I respect her so much for her willingness to stand for what was right. The last point I want to make is this. Mordecai made an appeal to Esther, as you all know, and he said, Esther, can you please go before the king and plead for our people? And I believe what he was doing is he was appealing to her to not become fatalistic. And fatalism is just the idea, well, God is sovereign and God is in control. He'll handle this no matter what. Esther refused a fatalistic mentality and accepted personal responsibility. I want to read for you Esther 3, 12 through 14. Mordecai said, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance from the Jews will arise from another place. Another place in the Hebrew is translated God. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to the royal position for such a time as this. Esther courageously stood for righteousness with no guarantee of a favorable outcome. And here's what I want to challenge myself and I want to challenge you. Take responsibility for the place that God has put you in at this moment. Whether it's in your job, whether it's in your family, if you're a father of children, a mother of children, if you are even at this church, take responsibility for the place that God has put you. He does not make mistakes. And he doesn't think, oh, what was I thinking? Here you are, and God has designed you specifically for a purpose. Take responsibility and watch as God uses you in miraculous ways to change the world that he has put you in. Right now, I'd like you to draw your attention to the video as we watch the plot continue to unfold.
I want to talk to the Jew. Him. Bow your head. You know I can make you do it. You know that.
He despises me. He insults me. He turns the sweet honey in my mouth to bitter bile.
You exercise the power of the king. do something.
Kill him.
It's beneath me to lay hands on him. Jews, they cheat us, then hoard their wealth to flaunt before us. They think themselves better than the rest. Jews, I don't want to hear anything more about them. We should destroy them. Destroy every man, woman, and child among them. All of them. All at once.
Forgive me, my lord. Forgive me. Haman requests to speak with you.
Let him in.
My lord, a most urgent matter that must be discussed away from indiscreet ears. A certain people scattered and dispersed among the populace in all the provinces of your kingdom.
Yes, come to the point.
Their laws are different.
There can be only one law.
One day in seven, they refuse to work. They hoard money and cheat on their taxes.
How do you suggest we solve the problem?
Eliminate the problem. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued for their destruction.
I cannot destroy my own subjects.
If law-breaking is tolerated, others will follow. Tributes and tax revenues decline.
Be logical, Haman. The dead yield no taxes,
It's not a question of taxes. I'll pay 10,000 talents silver into the king's treasury if need be. My lord, the stability of the entire kingdom is in danger. These people are capable of far worse. They can conspire against us. They already occupy important positions in every city of the kingdom. That's why I insist we rid ourselves of them.
If what you say is true, we must act. Who might these people be?
A small, insignificant clan, my king. If my king trusts me, I'll take care of the details personally.
There is no one else I can trust. You will be granted all the powers. I want to know nothing about the matter.
Lot falls to the 13th day.
And now the month.
The month of Adar is propitious.
The 13th of Adar.
Men cast the lots, but the gods decide.
The gods decide. I shall make ready.
Scribes! To every province in its own script. To every people in its own language. By a royal decree of Ahasuerus, let them destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children.
As you can see from the video, Haman's hatred fueled his policy for eradication of the Jews of Persia. And I'd like to pick up a little bit where Cheryl left off about Haman and really look for a second at the deep root of his hatred. And on your notes, the fill-in is, pride in our lives opens the door for hatred. And I think Haman's pride is what drove him to that deep hatred of the Jews. Proverbs 16:18 says, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." When Mordecai wouldn't bow to Haman, it was a slap in the face to his pride. In our own lives, pride opens that door for hatred. As I was researching for tonight, I've also been reading a biography about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Bonhoeffer was a pastor during World War II in Germany. And he stood for the truth of the Bible and for conviction that he had in his heart about who Jesus was in his life. He was even worked in the resistance against the Nazis. And Bonhoeffer gave his life for what he believed in a concentration camp. But in the late 1920s, Bonhoeffer visited the United States, and this is a few years before the plight of the Jews in Europe became severe. And Bonhoeffer was appalled at how white Americans treated African Americans in the United States. When I read that, it really stung me. He even says that the white pastors in the South were no different than anybody else in how they treated fellow human beings. And you can see that principle applied here in the story of Esther and the Jews in Persia, that Haman's pride drove him in that hatred. The pride of Lucifer caused him to get thrown out of heaven, and now we know him as Satan. The Amalekites, Haman's descendants, were the first ones to go up against the Israelites when they came out of Egypt. Pride's a dangerous thing. As I read about Bonhoeffer's experiences, a verse came quickly in my heart, Matthew 7:3. "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye?" It's a call for self-examination. And as I studied the story of Esther, that called out to me. Jesus gives us the answer, though, in Mark 12:30-31. "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." There's no room for ourselves in there. It's got to be others and God. And I think that's what was missing, obviously, in Haman's case. But pride, I think, is the driving force behind that deep hatred and something that we have to look at, like Cheryl was talking about. Any small prejudices that can spring up and be a source of anti-Semitism or even worse, genocide in the case that Haman was plotting here. Thankfully, though, God provides deliverance. We're going to watch a quick video, and then Kelly is going to talk to you about deliverance.
Mordecai. Mordecai. Mordecai.
Hadassah.
Shh. I'm Esther. Go. Gather all the Jews to be found in Susa. Fast on my behalf. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day.
Esther, if only I could have spared you with this, I...
Do as I command. I and my handmaids will fast also. Then I will go to the king, though it is against his law. If I perish, I perish.
May the Lord protect you, Esther.
Come in aid of your servants. We are in overwhelming danger. Father, you who chose our fathers.
You who punished us and turned us over to our enemy because we have sinned against you. Still not happy, they want us to be completely annihilated.
Do not
allow them to triumph, Lord, but turn their plans against them. And strike the first of our persecutors.
Put the words that will touch the heart of my king into my mouth. Let them remind him of the love he once felt for me. And turn his heart against those who hate and battle against us.
Let him be the one to yield. Free me. Free me.
Deliver me from my anguish.
I've been waiting for months. I have no intention!
Do not fear, Esther.
If it pleases the king.
What is your request, beloved queen? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom.
At that very moment, deliverance was set into play. You see, Esther didn't go hastily with this. It was a well thought out plan. She knew her only hope was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And she knew that the only way deliverance would come to her people is if she went before him, the God that she served, and begged for his deliverance. I believe in the moment when we go back to Esther 4, Mordecai says, "Esther, you cannot think that you will be saved. But I tell you that deliverance will come." And I know Mordecai said that because Mordecai knew the covenant that God had made with Abraham long ago. He knew the Jews would be saved. But he said to Esther, "Esther, do you not think that this is your time? That this is why?" And we refer to in our American society as a light bulb moment. I believe that was a light bulb moment for Esther. I believe everything came together and she said, "This is it. This is why
I went through what I've gone through, and I've done what I've done, and I've been faithful, and I have followed my cousin Mordecai, and I've done the things, and I have served you, and is this my moment for you to use me for your great glory? God has a purpose for the situations he has placed us in. And courage is important. Don't get me wrong. Courage is so important. But Esther also had a well-thought-out plan and sought God for help and guidance. Esther was in a predicament. If you read back, she says to Mordecai, "Mordecai, you have to understand, I have not been brought before the king in 30 days. Now, this was very unusual. So something had gone awry. And I think it is so key that in the video you had seen that she prays, "God, remind the king of the love he once had for me." Because she knew that was her ticket in. If he remembers why he chose me, he'll hand his scepter out to me and accept what I have to say. And after 3 days of fasting, she called out for help. She said, "Tell all the Jews in Susa, tell them to pray and fast, for I'm going to do this. But Mordecai, I tell you, no matter what happens, if I die, I die, but I will do this. I will take the courage." And she went, and the story goes on. She was extended the golden scepter. There was two banquets that took place. Smart lady. I think she had the first one to remind him once again why you chose me, and that he would fall in love again, and she had a second one. And in the second banquet, the king says to her, "Please tell me, what is it that you want? And let me remind you, Haman was also there." Esther looks at him and says, "You need to understand something, king. This evil man that you have high in your rankings has a plot against me and my people." At that moment, Esther revealed who she was. The king did not know. Esther revealed who she was in that moment, risk number one. Risk number two, she was calling out somebody that the king very much trusted so much that he handed his signet ring over, that signet ring, and in that moment is what set this decree and this destruction into motion. And she called him out. The king was livid. Left the palace, went into the garden. He comes back to find Haman begging for his life, but he doesn't know he's begging for his life. He thinks that Haman's assaulting her, which then rises up even more anger. I believe God set all this in motion to turn the king's heart in that moment to say, "Something has gone awry and I need to fix it." The queen says to him, "Please, please do something to help me and my people." This is a key part. Haman's act to annihilate the Jews could not be reversed because there was a law that said whatever the king's signet ring was stamped on, whatever he set into motion could never be recanted, could never be taken back, nothing. So that was a factor in the story. And this point is so key, I believe, in our lives. Sometimes in our lives, decisions and decrees are put into place because of whatever reason, and it looks like we are unable to reverse what has been done. The damage has been done, like you would say. And our deliverance has to come through a plan that will offset the damage that has been set into motion. Like when Jesus came. See, when God created the heavens and the earth, and he created man and woman, Adam and Eve, never intended for there to be death and destruction. However, he gave freedom. And he told Adam and Eve, "Go about it. There's one thing you can't touch, but the rest of it, I give you free reign over this garden, over the animals." And what happened? They took advantage of that freedom. The devil came in to lie. Eve partook of the tree. Adam partook of the tree, and in that moment, a decree and destruction was set into motion on this earth. God knew in his sovereignty and his all-knowing who he is, he knew this would happen, but it was never his intention. And I believe that many of us, maybe you don't, but there are times in my life where I think, "God, why in that moment didn't you just fix it? You're God. Just fix it. Just make it all better. Put it all back to beautiful. But he couldn't, because it was his plan, and because of the freedom he gave Adam and Eve, they set something in motion. However, God in his great goodness had another decree and another plan to offset the death and destruction. He sent his son to this earth to walk amongst us, to die on the cross, to shed his blood. And in that moment that he shed his blood, a different decree was set into motion to offset the destruction in our lives. And so the story goes that Esther and Mordecai was, Esther was given all of Haman's. Haman was killed. He had him killed, and he was actually impaled on the structure that Haman had originally created to murder Mordecai on. And then the story goes that the time came, a decree was set out that said to the Jews, you can defend yourselves. When this day comes and people come to kill you, you have the right to defend yourselves. And not only do you have the right to defend yourselves, but you have the right to take everything from everybody you kill. So the day came. And it's interesting, in the story it says that all of these people came to destroy the Jews, and very soon they figured out that this was not a good idea. The Jews were prepared. They were there to defend themselves. Another interesting part of the story that I just want you to hold on to and think about later, the Jews took nothing from those people. They were allowed to, but they didn't. So they had their victory, and the deliverance came. On Purim, we celebrate the salvation of the Jews from the plot of destruction that evil has placed against them. Many Jews also celebrate what they call a personal or special Purim to commemorate the anniversary of particular deliverances. For us, the most important deliverance that has ever come was to set us free from the guilt of our sins. Romans 5:1 says, therefore, since we have been made right in God's sight by faith, we have peace with God because of what Jesus Christ, our Lord, has done for us. However, there are many other moments of deliverance. However, there's many of you in here tonight that still need deliverance from the things, from the decrees that have been set into place in your life. Some of them, you had nothing to do with it. It's something that happened in your family. It's something that happened around you. Something that's been set into motion, whether it be sickness or marital problems or whatever it may be. There are some of you in here who have set your own destruction into motion. All of us have been there. I've been there. And there comes addiction and repetitive sin and anger and disappointments. Some of you, the decree that has been set into motion is that you have a prodigal child. And you're thinking to yourself, there's no hope. The beauty of God is that he has a decree to offset the decrees of the enemy. His blood was shed on a cross, and at that moment, that decree was set in motion that said, I will set you free of any other decree or any other destructive plan in your life. Another key part of the story is that Esther sought help. Esther knew, I've got to go before my God and I've got to beg him. We as Christians are so into this. We close ourselves in. We don't talk about our issues because we're so afraid of what the world around us may think. I'm a Christian and I have a prodigal child. I'm a Christian and I have an addiction. I'm a Christian and my marriage is a wreck. There's something beautiful about going to somebody and said, there's a decree of destruction on my life. My marriage is a mess and I need you to come alongside of me and pray and fast and ask for God's deliverance. And how is that gonna come? And to bring people alongside of you. I have a prodigal son. I have a prodigal daughter who's out there and the decree of destruction has taken over his life and it is running rampant. And I need you to come with me to go before God to pray that the decree of the life that he shed and the blood that he shed would offset and bring my son or daughter home. Seek God for a plan. Ask him for deliverance. Don't be ashamed to speak and allow help to come. Take risk. Be courageous. Be a part of the decree to offset the plan of the enemy. So during this time of Purim and the days leading up, that freed us from our guilt, because tonight is Purim and tomorrow. But we're leading up to the day that our decree was set, that set us free, Easter. And from now, I'm asking you, from now till then, during these next couple of days, and even on till Easter, take a moment, or many moments, and think about that decree that was set to offset the destruction of the enemy. Seek the Lord for deliverance, for it will come if you ask. It will come. The worship team is going to come up and sing some songs. We are pushing it. We have 5 minutes till children need to be picked up. But if you need to come and you want prayer, or you want somebody to pray with you, if you want somebody to agree with you over the decrees that have been set against you and to agree with you that God's decree is stronger and bigger and better, come. Don't leave tonight in shame. Don't leave in guilt. Don't leave without the offset plan, because you don't have to live with that destruction. Tonight, as you're leaving, there's boxes back at each of these three doors behind you. And part of Purim and the celebration of Purim is to give to the poor. It was something that Mordecai made at the very last chapter of Esther. He said, we will give to the poor as part of our celebration, to give back in remembrance of the good that God has done and the deliverance that God has done. We will deliver other people out of their messes. So I'm encouraging you to give to that. It's a great cause. And also to join us to eat some Purim treats. But don't leave yet. If you don't feel like you've got things settled, settle them.
We hope that this message has spoken something personal to you. If you would like more information about our church family or service times, please call us at 303-424-2121 or visit us at our website, www.fbci.org. Faith Bible Chapel currently meets in our Family Worship Center, located on the corner of 62nd Avenue and Ward Road. We'll be right back.